You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 24th of March, 2021. I have a new book that's finally been released. It is kind of funny. If you go to the Amazon page, which we have linked here, you'll notice that the author, picture of this black guy, who apparently is from UNC Greensboro, apparently a sports writer, who is listed as, I mean, my name and you know all the money and everything else goes to me. But this guy may be surprised to learn that he is his picture is on my page. There's also a small problem in the paperback section on Amazon. It says it's independently published, and it is not. It's published, of course, by Hromada Books, and it's been put together by my friends at Russia Insider. This is now, I think, the fourth book of mine that they have, you know, we've worked on the cover and the fonts and everything else, and really almost at Paul Angel level quality. And as always, I want to thank them, and I want to thank everyone who has donated, because when you donate money to me, you make this kind of thing possible. This is a set of essays on medieval political philosophy, which I choose my words very carefully. It deals with everything really from the reign of Justinian to the Zealots and Thessalonica, and everything in between. There's a limited defense of scholasticism, something that Orthodox people don't understand and get wrong quite often. One other thing. I do realize that I don't necessarily respond to all of my emails. Now, you have to understand, I get a lot of them on several accounts, some of which I forget about. And often the questions are detailed. And if I don't get to them, it's nothing personal. I'm not deliberately ignoring you. And I apologize for that. That goes for everything on my Patreon page and everything else. There's only a few that I can get to. I used to be able to write to my donors individually. I can't do that anymore. You know, I've put out now 3 books in the space of a year. I should say published 3 books in the space of a year. Even though, it's a lengthy process of writing them. The only way I can do that is from the support of people like you. And I should also note, I keep forgetting about this, is that on my page, was sponsored by Radio Albion, there is a cryptocurrency option. I know very little about that. I think there's 3 or 4 versions, a couple of tokens, and of course the main one. And I understand that the value of these continues to go up. I mean, if you give a small amount, it just grows over time. And now I suppose the regime is getting involved in this, which is going to be fatal to it. They're going to eliminate the anonymity and all that. I don't know what Elon Musk is doing. I'm not really following the nonsense there. But you know, have a life. So I mean, this kind of thing is, I have to, you know, be careful what I follow. Once I follow something, I follow it in immense detail. And, you know, to the exclusion of everything else. So that is another option. Again, like everything else, I just keep forgetting about it. So, again, I'm not expecting this book to fly off the shelves. This book is the culmination of many years, and essays that have been published elsewhere, but I've completely rewritten them, given everything that I, you know, the knowledge level is changed and everything else. There's a lengthy section in there on medieval art. For some reason, I always thought that I had a particular talent for analyzing artworks. I'm not entirely sure why that is. I think in iconic terms, often, for better or for worse, rather than in linear terms. And that's something I wrote a long time ago, but it's been rewritten. And I have several, you know, images, both Western and mostly Western style paintings and icons, which again in the Orthodox world don't really get analyzed in detail. There's a lot of the Western, you know, Catholic and pre-Catholic ideas of Orthodox people don't really get into. They tend to condemn it without much knowledge. Scholasticism is one of those things. And they tend to reduce the High Middle Ages in the West to, you know, essentially some variation of the Frankish Empire and Scholasticism. And that's pretty much how they characterize the entire thing, which is nonsensical. And that's actually a very good segue into what I'm doing here. I'm doing something. I really did this, really almost, I've been playing with it, and it comes back, and it, you know, I never quite know where to go with it. It's on the idea of holy foolishness. This is one of those phenomena that you'll occasionally find some modernist Orthodox writer, you know, talking about in very grandiose terms, of course being completely unaware of the fact that the notion of what they call foolishness for Christ's sake is a mockery of exactly what they do. The fools for Christ, you can call them holy foolishness, whatever the term is something overwhelmingly existing only in the Eastern world. There's not that many of these people. It's an extremely difficult life to lead. These, of course, are not fools. They're not jesters either, which is a whole separate situation. But this is one of the most extreme forms of spiritual asceticism that anyone can imagine. It is an extreme exploit, as we may call it. It is renouncing external reason. It's even renouncing virtue in the sense that it renounces its external manifestation. It's a deliberate and voluntary acceptance of either an insane personality or a immoral person. They're not actually immoral, but they go out of their way to gain the reputation of being immoral, which of course really is the ultimate in asceticism. There's always that danger that even if you become legitimately holy over years, that people will begin congratulating you on that, which then may negate your entire purpose in doing it. The last thing you want to do is gain fans for this. There's been a lot of writing in Greek and Russian on this. The writing in English is usually worthless, like most of it is, because they can't comprehend. You know, it's like my stuff on Gogol. If, you know, a university professor writing on Gogol and you know, talking about the profundity of the ideas, having no clue that he's actually talking about them. Even at the end of The Government Inspector, a famous play, which I strongly recommend, The stage directions are, everyone on stage is supposed to stop, turn to the audience and say, we're talking about you. You're not just a spectator here, you're the problem. And even that's not enough to get these people to comprehend. Plato has a somewhat of a thought experiment in Republic and a few other places where he invites you to imagine being a virtuous person, pursuing a life of virtue, but no one notices it. In fact, just the opposite. You're living a life of legitimate virtue, but everyone thinks that you're vicious, full of vice. Would you still do it? Plato's argument is that because a life of virtue is objectively worthwhile, that you would do it anyway. Very few of us, though, could handle that for long. The fool for Christ's sake, the holy fool, deliberately cultivates a reputation of being immoral, of being hated, being violent, just as insane as you can get, with the purpose of mocking the notion of respectable Christianity based on rule following. It is an error of almost comic proportions. And you get this in certain vulgar elements of Catholicism. That's not actual Catholicism, but it's, you know, that very stereotypical view of it, that you get to heaven by going through this checklist of ideas and actions. And if you check them all off and you don't mess it up in any way, you go to heaven. If you mess it up a little bit, you go to purgatory, and then after a while you go to heaven. If you mess it up a lot, and you're really not checking the right boxes, you're damned. And that's what the faith is. Following rules. That is not what the church is. Rule following is the very lowest manifestation of the church. I can understand people starting off with that, just as a guide. But rules, number one, are written in language. Number two, they're contextual. And number three, they're connected to specific time periods. And we're talking about, you know, moral rules here. You know, you have to understand that if you go through the Rudder, the Book of Orthodox Canon Law, 90% of the canons are completely and totally ignored. Not the dogmatic canons, of course, but even there. But the canons dealing with behavior are almost completely and entirely ignored. The entire canonical structure of John the Faster is ignored. You should see some of these canons in there. No one could possibly follow them in 2021. They could have followed them 1,000 years ago, though. And it isn't so much that the standard is abandoned. We're just realistic enough to know that while we maintain the standard, we have no chance of reaching it. But rule following is an error, not in the least of which reasons is that once you follow the rules, and once you go through the checklist of things that I have to do and be in order to get into heaven, and even the phrase get into heaven is so vulgar. Therefore, God, you owe me this. I've done my part, now give me my money. Give me the payoff. And the only reason I'm doing this is because I'm getting a payoff here. The only reason I'm following this stuff and believing this stuff is because I don't want to go to hell. This is the absolute lowest, almost a destructive approach. Rules are problematic for the reasons I've mentioned. I've said 1,000 times that words today don't mean the same as they did 1,000 years ago, or 20 years ago, no matter what translation you're looking at. I've said many times, take John the Faster, have him born in 1971, like me, or rather than 1,000 years ago, like he was, and see if he writes the same canon. Send him to a university for 2 weeks and see what he writes. He lived in a very rational, by comparison, moral society. But even there, you had Christians by the boatload who did what they did because this is what you're supposed to do. This is what you're expected to do. The belief, even if it's real, is perfunctory. This is an error. And that respectable middle-class country club Christianity today is based entirely on it. The prophets of the Old Testament are a version of foolishness for a few reasons. Number one, they're nobodies. The prophets, with the exception of Isaiah, were unknown. These are just guy hicks from nowhere. And one of the reasons that God picks these people is that there's no way they could be saying this on their own, so you know it's from God. The second thing is that they condemn Israel in the most brutal terms. Number three, they parody the perfunctory performance of rituals. The famous publican, the Pharisee, where the Pharisee, you know, who is legitimately a holy man, but a holy man only in the sense that he follows the external rules. He actually has done nothing wrong in the sense that he's followed it. He's done everything he was supposed to do. But he does it because it's what's expected of him, not because he truly feels it. Love is this very, very intense connection with natural law that motivates you, that's not entirely amenable to reason. And that's the connection here. Fools for Christ completely abandon a rational approach because that only takes you so far. You know, why does poetry exist? Why does music exist? Why does painting exist? Why couldn't you just describe these things and get the same effect? It's almost silly to say that. You can't describe it because words are very weak. Words only go so far. To take Christianity and reduce it to a set of rules is to mock it. Now, in a dying postmodern society, in the Western world, that's all it is. You know, you pay your taxes, you don't murder anybody, and you're considered a good person. You try not to rape anybody. And that's pretty much the checklist here. If you don't do those things, you're a good person. Not a good man, not a good woman. You're a good abstract person. And that's pretty much the standard today. You know, women, of course, can do as they please. This is mostly for men. But still, that's, you know, and that vulgarity, that almost infantile way of thinking gets, it's a product of laziness. You know, you don't have to think very much. You just have to follow and memorize the rules. You follow the rule. One of my favorite scenes in The Sopranos is when Paulie goes to his priest, and he went to a some sort of a seance. It's a very famous scene, and he feels like these ghosts, the people he's killed, are following him around. Apparently, this psychic has seen them. And Paulie rushes into his parish priest and says, you know, I've been donating money to this place for a long time. How come I'm not being protected? The money I send should be giving me immunity to this stuff. You're not doing your job. And he says, I'm not giving you money anymore. He, honest to God, believes that if he gives a certain amount of money, gives a very perfunctory, even lip service to a few rules, that's to protect him from all evil. He takes the life that he leads in what they call what organized crime, and he simply takes that structure and puts it onto the church. Actually, one day I'm going to do something on organized crime and Catholicism in a way that no one's expecting me to talk about. Nevertheless, that's your classic example of what happens when you take the mentality of a sick society and you impose it not just on the church today, but on how the church must have functioned 1,000 years ago. the other problem with rule following is that we're talking about psychological motivation. The question is, the motivations for you to follow these rules. What is your purpose here? And how do you know really that you're following them? You know, what constitutes adultery? What constitutes theft? What constitutes any kind of violence? That gets extremely vague. And ultimately, these words fall apart. Because not only do they not mean the same as they did 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, but even our own psychological problems are constantly moving the goalposts. We're always rationalizing things. The notion of the judgment, we have to understand, isn't so much that God, you know, shows a big video screen like the idiots actually believe and says, okay, you haven't followed these rules, therefore you're going to burn forever and suffer, you know, something ridiculous like that. No. God doesn't do anything. What happens is that all of your rationalizations are taken away. All the things that we use to justify things, the excuses that we make, all of this is removed, and you have a perfectly clear understanding of what you've done and why. All the bad faith that we engage in to rationalize what we do or what we don't do is removed. Our conscience then is completely opaque, and this is what brings us either to experience God's love as pain or God's love as a wonderful utopian existence. The concept of heaven and hell have been reduced to vulgarity and just a simpleton's way of thinking, such that really it's a miracle that there are Christians left at all. With the nonsense idea that God is up in the sky somewhere. No conception. You can't have a society based on a decaying positivism with the worship of the scientific establishment. And that's the world that you think exists. And then want to talk about God on top of it. God doesn't make any sense in a world based on intellectual corruption. These people couldn't be Christians if they wanted to. Their entire mentality would have to be shifted. But this is exactly what the holy fools do. They do things that are shocking. They do things that are crazy in every sense of the term. They do things to spit at, sometimes literally spit at, those with power, and especially those in the church who really do follow all the rules and think that they're wonderful as a result. You can follow all of the rules and still be an absolutely disgusting destroyer of the church. But because it's so easy, and if it's easy, you'll do it, because it's so easy to reduce everything to rule following. You know, I haven't killed anybody, so God owes me heaven. And it comes from lazy, it comes from ignorance, it comes from being raised in this society that reduces everything to one-liners and images. And of course, there's no way you could even begin to approach the church with that mentality. What the holy fools do is they try to reveal the contradiction between grace on the one hand and the moral laws on the other. You know, in the Middle Ages, you had, in many very important ways, a fully Christian society. The problem there is that people simply conform for the sake of conforming. There's nothing Christian about that. You know, they simply do what they do, not because they care, it's because that's what everyone's doing. I don't want to get into trouble. They, you know, the constant repetition is one of the worst aspects of especially these Bible Protestants today. The same slogans, you know, phrases like Christ died for our sins over and over again. People don't even know what that means. Ask them what that means. You know, what does it mean to die for yours? What the heck does that even, that doesn't even make sense in our English. What is he referring to there? And because it's done so often and with such ridiculous levels of repetition, that most people will roll their eyes. And they should. This is why you get that cringy feeling whenever someone just starts, you know, preaching the gospel. You know, in the most inappropriate way. Talking about God's love in a YouTube comment about, you know, types of soils. And you've all seen this out of nowhere. And it's the most ridiculous thing. They're mocked, and they should be mocked. They think they're doing the right thing. But because it's so inappropriate, and that's that same almost saccharine language that they actually destroy what they're trying to promote. Assuming they're trying to promote anything. The holy fools mock this stuff. And almost in this sense, sound like, and sometimes you do this, you sound almost anti-Christian telling these people to shut up. That you don't have the context. It's so inappropriate as to walk into a restaurant and start talking about the resurrection. The middle-class American has no conceptual background to understand resurrection. They have no idea. You know, they still think God, to the extent that he exists at all, is up in the sky. And that everything is based on rule following. They'd rather not follow, they'd rather follow the world's rules. That's okay, because if it's legal, it must be good. The holy fool is one of the most intense of the prophets. Because of their complete rejection of the society around them, including Christian society. They're completely outside of culture. They're outside of time. And to a great extent, even outside of language. They won't allow themselves to be limited by any of those things. Usually they wander around naked. An old Russia and Byzantium. You don't see these, you know, again, there's not many of these people. Ksenia of Petersburg, you know, after her husband died, dressed up in men's clothing, and wandered around, you know. And if you see, you know, someone, you know, talking to trees and babbling, they're not crazy. They're talking to trees because they're mocking what a typical conversation is like. You're better off talking to trees. This is what you're doing, they would say. This isn't rule following. And then they'll do something so outrageous, like they'll defecate in the street, which is, you know, they've done. To finally snap these people out of their just day-to-day conformism. Forcing them to, why is that a problem to do that? And usually you can't, other than saying it's disgusting, they really don't know why it's a problem. But everything's just a matter of preference, right? You shock these people into thinking. And, you know, to what extent it succeeds, it doesn't matter. It's the most extreme way of rejection of basic social conformity and bad faith. It's almost a concealment. Now, these are highly ascetic and virtuous people, and they're aware of this. But striving to be a fool and to openly sin is to avoid people congratulating you on your holiness, to be absolutely virtuous. I mean, they're doing these things not because they think it's a good thing, you know, hanging out with in bathhouses and stuff like that. They're doing it so people think that they're actually into that stuff. No, they have no intrinsic, they hate it. But in order to be fully virtuous, they can't have people thinking that they're virtuous. The concept of divine wisdom and the rules of society is this contradiction is what's exploited and mocked. Your typical Protestant fundamentalist today will say you follow the basic rules of society. You're married because the state says you're married. You're divorced because the state says you're divorced. You better pay your taxes and join the army because that's what society demands, no matter who's running this thing, no matter how evil all this stuff is put to, because that's what Christianity demands. And they'll cite, you know, Romans, just the most ridiculous non-sequiturs, and they actually believe this. You've all heard this before. This is what's to be mocked. If they actually believe that that is Christianity, that we have to spit on it, even if we don't want to, we spit on it to mock them, to parry them. The immorality that these people display. They go through the motions, but they're not actually doing it. They're repulsed by it. But the immorality that these people demonstrate, it's a mockery of worldly depravity, of the conformist virtue. Virtue because that's what everyone else is doing. A contemporary example would be the concept of extremism. Anyone uses that word in a non-ironic way is an idiot. Because what was extreme yesterday is normal today, and vice versa. You would think that they would understand that very simple concept, but they don't. Talking about avoiding extremism makes them sound harmless and reasonable. It's a virtue signal. But that phrase, virtue signal, is exactly what we're talking about. They're not virtuous. They just don't want to be called names on the internet. They don't want to lose their job. They don't want the FBI at their front door. So to be as extreme as possible and still be truly virtuous, that's a mockery of their ridiculous conformism. Their absolute lack of thought, their inability to follow a logical train of reasoning from beginning to end. They can't do that. And if they can't do that, then what is the point of using logic to try to convince them otherwise? You have people who today will fully admit that the last election for president was completely subverted and fraudulent. They'll tell you this. They'll go through all the evidence that it's all phony. Then you ask them, well, what are we going to do about it? And they'll actually say, we need to get more people in our elections in the future and get our good people in Congress. You've heard this, but can you imagine that level, totally bankrupt, no ideas, no creativity, nothing. They don't know what else to do. After just saying the elections are a sham in this country, we'll then say we have to run good people for the next election because they have nothing else. They have absolutely nothing else to mock this stuff, even in a depraved way, you know, to rip up his voting ID or something like that to keep him from that's something that a holy fool would do. It's a wise foolishness. The wisdom of the world has nothing to do with logic or reason. It's simple conformity because they're scared. You can follow all the rules and be completely and utterly depraved. One has nothing to do with anything. Now, these people, and you see this in parts of Byzantium, and then especially in Novgorod, in Russia, 15th, 16th century, the holy fool begins to come into their own. They're terrified primarily of being a holy, you know, whatever it is, a holy layman or a holy monk, and so they can't deal with the congratulations. Oh, you're such a prophet. Oh, my God, you have such insight. No, that will destroy their humility. And in many cases, they will deliberately provoke someone to act. They'll get them enraged. They'll get them angry. In old Russia, the holy fool, like, for example, Basil the Blessed, that St. Basil Cathedral in Moscow is named after. It's not St. Basil the Great. St. Basil's in Moscow is named after the holy fool, Basil. And this particular Basil is the one who confronted Ivan the Fourth. Not only did he confront Ivan the Fourth, but Ivan the Fourth, Ivan the Terrible, listened to him and became a promoter of his sanctity, even carried his coffin when he died. Ivan the Fourth is marching into Pskov to crush the oligarchs there, and the elites, the oligarchs of the town, come out to meet him, trying to placate him, and there's this guy, naked, screaming stuff, spitting, filthy. Ivan pays no attention to the oligarchs because he knows they're saying things out of obligation. They're scared of him, and he pays attention only to St. Basil. And the upshot of his message was, you are so concerned with not eating meat during Lent, but I wonder if grinding up human meat in these wars that you're engaged in would might be also a part of the fasting regimen you might want to look into. And Ivan, being a very holy monarch his whole life, took that very seriously, and he was ashamed. He didn't have any choice in the matter, but he was aware of exactly what was being said to him. I've come across this recently, men whose lives have what we call zeroed out. They've lost everything, marriage, job, money, children, everything. You know, some of you know, it wasn't that long ago I was in that position, 2014, 2015. I was in that exact position. I know exactly what it's like. And even then, and I've come across this more recently, that Lent comes around, and I suddenly become concerned with my diet. And you have to laugh. My life is a living hell. I have no reason to wake up in the morning. And yet I'm concerned with eating meat. That's the big issue. It's almost a mockery of the whole thing. I'm living, well, I'm not just me, I'm talking, you know, and this has come up recently with several friends of mine. This happens all the time. They're living in an actual burning purgatory. The last thing you want to talk to them about is get all upset because they ate a hot dog on Friday. It's laughable. That's even an issue, given everything else that's going on. It just shows you you're kind of hanging on to something familiar because you can't deal with the chaos and evil that's surrounding you. This is what Basil's talking about with Ivan the Terrible. Yes, he's very, very strict about his Lenten fast. But that has nothing to do with how he actually behaves. This is a formal, he's adhering to these. And again, Ivan took this very, very seriously. He didn't listen to the oligarchs and Piskov coming out. He listened only to Basil and became a follower of St. Basil for the rest of his life. The reason that Basil the Blessed ever was canonized was in large part because of Ivan's insistence. The fact that this man has Basil Cathedral in Moscow named after him, this filthy, babbling lunatic. Of course, he was not. He was very wise and very humble, but he deliberately acted that way because he knew that would get Ivan's attention. You're in the middle of a war, you're in the middle of a campaign. The last thing you want to do is go through some logical design because that's not going to change anything. If you're being ruled by the passions for whatever reason, you're not listening to reason. So how can you possibly go up to them and rationalize with them and use reason with them? They're not paying attention to it in the first place. It doesn't make any sense. What other options do you have? Well, he can't shoot him. So he engaged in this almost mocking and being completely outside of the society and refusing to dress and refusing to, he didn't have a house, he didn't have any money, he didn't have a job, he didn't have anything. Didn't have a bishop, didn't take any of that seriously, at least in his outward appearance. Showing that this is a manifestation of pure grace, not an institution. How many times have I said on this show and in my writings that institutions are as much of a curse as anything else? Because institutions are bureaucracies. And bureaucracies simply regularize our life, turn it into a set of steps, a checklist, a procedure you have to go through with everything. Pretty soon you're on autopilot. You're actually not doing anything at all. This is not the same thing as a ritual. It's a mockery of the concept of a ritual. So the holy fool refuses to have anything to do with any institution. He is completely alone and literally naked in front of the world. And he mocks and deliberately confronts and spits at and throws things at these very proper Christians who look down on him because, you know, how dare he look like that and talk like that. He, of course, is absolutely right. You know, the contemporary variation of what he said to Ivan would be, you know, you're an Orthodox man working for a bank, high up in a bank. Sure, you're going to be very, very concerned with not eating meat during Lent, but you have no problem in grinding up the poor with usury. Maybe that's something you might want to incorporate into your Lenten fast. But they won't. They could rationalize that because it's legal and it's considered normal. So it's okay. I'm going to get away with it. I have money, so the local parish priest is not going to say anything to me. He can't risk being like Paulie and have his donations pulled. Because, again, they're part of an institution. Even if they hate that kind of thing, they have no choice. They're running an institution. You need money. You need support. You need coalitions. You need to be nice. You need to play all sides against each other to get it to run. The last thing you have to be is good. Because institutions steamroll over goodness. A synod is not the church. Sometimes a synod could be the opposite of a church. It's almost divinizing a bureaucracy. That the procedure of a bureaucratic protocol is the same thing as a good Christian life. I mean, that's one of the things that some of the more traditional Russians condemned Sergius for, the time of the Russian Revolution, wasn't so much that he, and this is another, I mean, the fact that he was looking at the gulag in the faith, they were going to kill hundreds of priests if he didn't sign that thing. Any of us would have signed it. How dare anyone condemn him? He was wrong, but doesn't mean you condemn him. Anyone would have done that. If he didn't sign it, they would have beheaded God knows how many priests in front of him. And people condemn him knowing full well that if they were there, they'd be the first person marching up and down Red Square with a red flag and rationalizing. So I don't want to be extreme. There's no point in this. I'll do what I'm told because that's what the Bible says. You know, obey the authorities. They'll say something like that. No, the problem with Sergius was that he did follow the canons and the laws of the church very, very strictly. That didn't mean that he was right. One has nothing to do with the other. So the fool, for Christ's sake, deliberately mocks that mentality by refusing to have anything to do with an institution. Rules fail, not only because they're based on words, and we can make words, mean whatever we want. Words become talismans. The true Orthodox Church talks about ecumenism as if that's the only issue in the world. But of course, every time they come across it, they define it a little bit differently. Anything, if you say hello to a Protestant, you're guilty of ecumenism. You stepped on the landmine with the 1983 anathema. Can you imagine talking like this in, you know, just in general society? What a jerk you're going to sound like. No, you can't talk like that. You can't, you know, inappropriately talk about these things in a society that doesn't recognize any of it. So when mocking these people and making fun of these people, you're not attacking the faith. You're not attacking these documents. But you're attacking these people who honestly believe that they're virtuous for talking like that. Well, it's Lent, so I'm not going to bathe. It's Lent, so I'm not going to, you know, and they actually believe that this has something to do with virtue. The fools for Christ mock this. They're not doing it because they think that this is going to bring them closer to God. They're doing this to get congratulated. Look how strict I am. I finally found a jurisdiction that's worthy of me. So the holy fool could never create an order. He could never create a rule like a monastic rule. They're always alone. There's never any more than one holy fool. Once Basil the Blessed was canonized, 1588, the phenomenon of the holy fool began to grow. especially in the Russian north. It's not a surprise that it grew mostly in Pskov and Novgorod because they were the oligarchic cities. In an oligarchic institution, money buys you everything, including piety. You're a good Christian man because you go to church when you have to, and you're a very prominent member of society. You couldn't possibly be a criminal because of how he dresses and how successful he is, and people want their kids to grow up like that. That's why the Fool for Christ phenomenon occurred there. It occurs almost overwhelmingly in cities where you have mass conformity. The belief that somehow, if you're financially successful, having no clue what that actually means, you're financially successful, therefore, you're a prominent, virtuous citizen. And how wonderful it is that such a person goes to church every Sunday, having no idea of what else this person might do, whether the institution that he represents, whether it be usury or the military, is you know, all this, but they're not going to be extremists and get into trouble, so they won't say anything about it. And that just gives them additional power. It shouldn't surprise anybody that when Peter the Great installed his purely bureaucratic model of the church on Russia, there was an official decree banning the Fool for Christ. And they used the excuse of people who mocked that. I mean, they actually were insane. They pretended to be a monk. There's a few people that we know of like that, pretending to be monastics, kind of just wander around, pretending to be, you know, crazy. And in fact, they really are. They're not actually pretending. And that was a problem. Of course, with everything, you're going to have phonies. But using that as an excuse, this is what Peter the Great, and it's how significant that he banned the Fool for Christ, because everything became part of a bureaucracy. Everything was about following canons, like they're an American penal law. You know, you commit this crime, you get 2 years. You commit another crime, you get 3 years. This has nothing to do with punishment, even. This has nothing to do with rehabilitation. This has to do with simply following a list. You know, if you go through the DSM-5, which is the absolutely ridiculous, huge, I read this thing all the time, really almost for fun. It's all based on social norms. None of these are actually real, and they're going to admit it. These so-called illnesses only exist because society frowns on them. Because people look down on them. They're not actual things. Only in a society that values certain things. So if a society values individualism, for example, anything that rejects that is going to be considered some sort of a mental illness. That's what happens all the time. They're medicalizing everything. And they actually say in all of these definitions they use in the encyclopedia of mental illnesses, they say prevailing social norms. It goes against prevailing social norms over and over and over again. Meaning it has nothing to do objectively. If you're looked down on by society, therefore you have a mental problem. If you believe in what the regime believes in, no matter how ridiculous and delusional it is, you're considered healthy. And this is the phenomenon that the Fool for Christ, really the prophetic element, is attacking. So what these people do is refuse in their life and death struggle with sin, with vanity. They're at war with pride by deliberately doing things to anger people. They're deliberately committing sins so no one thinks that they're virtuous. You can commit a sin and not be a sinner, because the issue is not what you do, it's your mentality before you do it. That's what you're judged on. There's no way you could possibly know the consequences of any action. Especially over time. It's your intention. It's how your mentality is, how your mind is organized, how it's ordered. That's what matters. That's the only thing really you can control. And even that's iffy. You know, one thing that psychology has done well is it's completely destroyed any concept that our motivations are opaque. Most of us have no idea why we do what we do. No one acts freely. No one acts from calculation. No one acts from self-interest. There are so many pathological things going back to our childhood that determine how we act that we really don't know why we do what we do. Most of us grown up in a society where people deliberately hurt themselves. They destroy themselves. Happiness is something that they run from. Freedom is something that they can't stand because it has to do with responsibility. That goes against every liberal dogma. And here I'm using the word dogma in a negative sense. It's something that you just believe in because you have to, because everyone does, or you think everyone does. What I'm saying is, the fool for Christ rejects the external coding of social dignity. He mocks the bemused, what they call the bemused mastery of the elitist, believing that he's a man of dignity because he goes to church on Sunday. He doesn't care. This is something that good people are supposed to do. And they'll deliberately, they'll put themselves in, they'll deliberately come out of a brothel so people can see them. So people will not think that they're virtuous. And no one will go to them and provoke their pride. This is humility raised to a heroic degree. That's the concept. The fool for Christ refuses any love from people, any support from people. He doesn't want a good memory of himself. Christ alone is the foundation. They see themselves as in this agonizing exile, drowning in evil and injustice. But because evil and injustice are built into the way that people think, there's no way to approach them. You can't reason with someone whose very cognitive structure is based on corruption and sickness. There's no place to argue. What other options do you have? Madness is a way to subvert the arrogance of the elite. It's a mockery of what people value, what people think is important. It's a way to, it's something very similar to we mock Clown World. You've seen the meme where a guy is putting on clown makeup as he's spouting the various virtue signals that you're supposed to spout in order to get a job in this country. How wonderful it is that trannies are given the rights that they deserve, and he's saying this, he's putting clown makeup on. That's an excellent example, a secularized example, of what the fool for Christ did. We've seen protests where some of our people have crashed these tranny demonic story time things in a clown outfit. That is a secularized version of exactly what the fools for Christ were doing. It's very powerful that they're dressed in a clown outfit. Yes, they're going to be mocked for it. But that image is going to shake people out of their lethargy in a way that simple logical reasoning, which they couldn't comprehend anyway, could never do. The fool for Christ was always a populist figure. He usually was very popular. Because whenever an elite government official or a wealthy person would come into town, he would be the first to, throw things at his carriage and spit at him and mock him and parody him. But in old Russia, you were not allowed to touch these guys. Wherever the Tsar was, right up until the revolution, fools for Christ were permitted to come in and out. They wandered around. And they had the obligation almost. They could do what they wanted, of course. But the fool for Christ was to mock them and attack them. Because sometimes they don't hear that. You know, an elite today is surrounded by yes men. That's all they do. They have no conception of the real world. None. The fool for Christ is, you know, it's like, you know, we post something crazy just to get under their skin. There's some rationality to that. The whole mean thing is based on that to a lesser extent. It's to mock them. It's to parody them. We're not going to convert them. They're not rational to begin with. Their whole way of thinking is perverted, so you can't use reason if that's the case. But we can use images. We can use mockery. The fools for Christ came into existence in places that were run by oligarchs. You even see it. You see it even in the West, in northern Italy, wherever the oligarchs rule, the fools for Christ come into existence. I'm thinking of Giovanni Colombini, who very few people talk about. Now, this was when the Medicis had captured the papacy. The entire church bureaucracy was subverted to the Medici banking clan. The only thing that anyone can do is not to write treatises, which you would never get out anyway, not to approach these people logically, because they actually believed that logic was, you know, that logic was on their side no matter what. That this was just reasonable to be and support them. That you could be extremist otherwise. You'd get burned at the stake like Savonarola. So what options do you have? How do you approach these people? It's to mock them, to parody them, and to be vulgar and even sounding stupid, but for that particular reason. The fools mocked superficial rule following, superficial learning. They stood up often for the humiliated. They're always connected with oligarchic society. They exist outside of culture. They exist outside of time, even language. Sometimes they don't speak at all. They grunt. They make noise. They're the total opposite of an institution. They don't have any form. They're purely fluid. They're at war with standardized piety, and they mock it. Famous line of Basil to Ivan. And you can think of so many ways to use this. You're so concerned about not eating meat during Lent, but when you're destroying villages, you know, you have no problem with that. You're so concerned with these external rules, you're not even worried about what you're doing. These rules have an end, have a further purpose other than themselves. They reject all forms of class status, and they mock the pretensions of these people. The wealthy who go to church and go to the front of the place with their prayer book and do these pompous, very showy prostrations and everything else, they're to be mocked. And sometimes directly, sometimes almost in a criminal way, to shake them out of their arrogance. Because no one else is going to do it. You can't reason with them. You can't kill them. So what are your options? Your option is to go right up to them and mock them and even some symbolic way to spit at them. And that's exactly what they did. They held up a mirror to these people. The way that they looked and the way that they acted, they showed that what these people are doing is purely conventional. You're going along because this is what you think you have to do. I'm wealthy, therefore I have to dress a certain way. I have to act a certain way. It means nothing to me other than that. They rocked the world of these people. And the only way to do it in a dying society is in the most extreme kind of parody, direct mockery. So an oligarch is walking down the street and they're accosted by a homeless guy. They have the products of their own policy rammed in their face. He stinks. He's filthy. And because he's homeless, he has nothing to lose. He goes right into the face of these people and tells them off. What can you do against a guy like that? What are you going to take from him? He has nothing to take. And because they deliberately put themselves in a position to be mocked and hated, you have no leverage over these people. They can do whatever they want. In old Russia, they were institutionalized, at least in a limited way, that you couldn't touch them, you couldn't have anything to do with them, you had to listen to them, and you had to take them seriously. They were listened to before, in some cases, before advisors were listened to. And why would that be? Because advisors maybe be telling you what you want to hear. They're following a pre-programmed ideology. Easy answers, one-liners. They're trying to sound smart. They're trying to sound urbane. That's what's motivating them. But the fool, the lunatic, they're saying things that no one else has the guts to say. They're outside language. They're outside culture. They're outside time. This is the most extreme kind of asceticism. They hold up a mirror to the respectable middle-class Christian and spit on them. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.